We're going to talk about our new and revived global outreach philosophy here at Northeast. And I just want to tell you, all that we do here locally and all that we do here around the globe would not be possible without the money that you give to this church. Plain and simple. Every week, check this out. Every single week we are able to show thousands. And we've never been able to say this before in the history of Northeast Christian Church, but I can say it today. Every week we are able to show thousands of people the love of Jesus. All around our church, all around our city, and all around our world. Thousands. I think most people just want to make a difference with their lives. If you invest in Northeast Christian Church, you are impacting thousands every week. And I want you to know that none of it would be possible without faithful givers sacrificing to fund the heart and the hopes and the mission of our church. Jesus once said, where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. And I just want to thank you today for giving God and giving us a piece of your heart, because none of this would be possible without it. Now, like I said, we're going to talk about global outreach today. Before we get down to some of the philosophies and strategies that are unique to us, I just want to remind you of something that most of you already know. 2,000 years ago, Christianity started on the other side of the globe. And what's so unique about Christianity and what makes it so attractive and appealing to me is that over the last 2,000 years, it has stretched out its arms, and you can now find it on every single continent. In fact, compared to every other world religion, compared to every other political worldview, economic system, you pick your choice. Nothing has shown the cultural flexibility, the global diversity that Christianity has. It is literally everywhere. Islam is not as culturally diverse as Christianity. Judaism is not as culturally diverse as Christianity. Hinduism and Buddhism, atheism is not as culturally diverse as Christianity. Democracy, communism, socialism, capitalism, pick your ism, none of them have been able to be as culturally transcendent as our faith system. That's compelling to me. Now, I've walked you through this before, but I think it's worth walking you through this again. All right, I want to show you how Christianity has moved its epicenter all around the world. And I think this is the movement of God in the world. It started 30 years ago in Jerusalem when Jesus died and rose from the dead, 30 AD. So I have for you the top left corner a picture of a modern day Jerusalem man. That's where the epicenter of the church resided for the next 15, 20 years. That's where the leaders were. That's where the first church council was held. Then around the year 45 to 50 AD, the epicenter of Christianity began to shift to a city known in the scriptures as Antioch. It's in modern day Syria for us. There's a picture of a Syrian woman in the top middle. And the reason why Christianity moved to Antioch was because a guy named Paul met Jesus. Now, before Paul met Jesus, his name was Saul, and he terrorized Christians. But then he met Jesus, he switched teams, and he became one of the most prolific writers, thinkers, and church planners in the history of Christianity. And his goal was to take Christianity to the world. In fact, that's why his home base was in Antioch. He wanted the church to know that Christianity, Jesus, is not just for Jerusalem Jews. It's not just for Jerusalem Jews, it's for the world. And he took it to the world. Now, over the next 15 years, the epicenter of Christianity began to shift again toward Rome. Paul, Peter, other leaders in the early church thought, if we can get it to the capital of the world, the capital of the empire, then we can get Christianity out to the world. It is the cultural hub. It is the city that all other cities follow. And so they took it to Rome, and over the next 260 years, Christianity spread around Rome like a virus. It was unstoppable. Even though it was a minority religion, even though it was an unofficial religion, even though they were persecuted to death during different seasons over the next three centuries, Christianity was unstoppable. One third century theologian named Tertullian once said, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." And what he meant by that was, every time they kill a Christian, it just seems like 10 more pop up. So much so that by the turn of the third to the fourth century, Christianity became the national religion of the entire Roman Empire. Think about that. 300 years earlier, they killed Jesus. 300 years later, they worshiped Jesus as king. Now, our Eastern Orthodox brothers and sisters would say that the epicenter of Christianity next shifted from Rome to Istanbul, Turkey. And out of respect to them, I have a picture of one first a Roman cardinal and then a Turkish lady there, middle row, far left. But nobody would disagree that by the 16th century, the epicenter of Christianity then shifted to Germany. Now, why Germany? Well, it was because of this fiery priest named Martin Luther, who started this movement called the Protestant Reformation, right? Protestant Reformation. And for the next 200 years, Christianity revolved around Germany. Now, last 200 years, Christianity made a fortuitous shift for us, and it came across the Atlantic Ocean and to the United States of America. And I'm thankful it finally made its way here, aren't you? Because we wouldn't be here right now. It's interesting to think, for the first 1600 years of Christianity or so, it was not the prevailing religion in our country. You know that, right? The Christian community in America is young compared to some of the communities in Ethiopia, in India, in Palestine, across the Middle East, around the Mediterranean rim. Like, we're just babies compared to them. However, over the last 200 years, we've been a powerful baby because a lot of missionary activity, a lot of church innovation, and a lot of scholarship has come out of our country. Now, once again, I think the movement of God has shifted. And it shifted away from Europe, it shifted away from America, and into the global South. That's where we see God doing his most explosive work today. Christianity is exploding in Latin America. It's exploding in Africa. It is exploding all over Southeast Asia. Some social scientists say that by the year 2030, China will have somewhere around 250 million Christians. And imagine how that will change the world. Now, with all that being said, ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you the historic and global face of Christianity. And it's beautiful, but it doesn't necessarily look like you or me. Did you know that somewhere around 9 out of 10 Christians on the globe today do not even live on our continent? And I'm okay with that. And there is no other religion, no other worldview, no other system of thought that can lay claim to something like that other than ours, other than Christianity. It's a beautiful thing about us. Now, the question is why, though? Why has Christianity shown such cultural fluidity and flexibility? Well, in my humble opinion, it boils down to something really, really simple. From the very beginning, our founder, Jesus, gave us a global mandate. You've probably heard both of Jesus' two great commissions. One he gave from Galilee in Matthew 28. The other he gave from just outside of Jerusalem in Acts chapter 1. But these are Jesus' last words to his disciples. He said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go and make disciples of all the, what church? The nations. Acts 1:8, he says, you'll be my witnesses telling people about me, where church? That would be everywhere, to the ends of the earth. Now, translation for you, Jesus gave us a global mandate from the start. He told us to take his love and his truth everywhere to everyone. That means there is no room for racism in the church because we have a global mandate. That means there is no room for ethnic prejudice in the church because we have a global mandate. That means there is no room for nationalism, cultural imperialism, or xenophobia in the church because we have a global mandate to take the love of Jesus to everyone and everywhere. And I am so thankful that 1,600 years of Christians that came before us thought the West worthy of the truth and the love of Jesus. Otherwise, we would not be here today. And we take the baton happily from them, and today, Northeast Christian Church, we carry it forward and we continue to take the love of Jesus everywhere else it needs to go. That's what today's about. Now, we're gonna do this a little bit different. Here in a second, I'm gonna invite one of our pastors on stage, and we're actually gonna talk you through our renewed vision for global outreach. Because, okay, for the last 3 years, we've just been talking about Love the Ville, right? Love the Ville this, Love the Ville that. We're gonna love our city, and all that's good and well. But last year, we said we wanna double our Love the Ville impact this year. And part of that is we are going to take Love the Ville and translate it globally to communities around the world. So we've got the vision, we've got the partners, we've got the new strategy and philosophy worked out, and we've got a new leader who is our global outreach pastor. And we just want to give you a peek behind the leadership curtain so you can figure out what's going on here around that going forward. So where's Josh? Josh, come on up here, man. Josh Rouse, would you welcome Josh Rouse, our global outreach pastor, to the stage? Come up, Josh. And he and I are just gonna, don't clap too long for him, he's not that cool. he and I are gonna have a conversation today about that. All right, so Josh, a lot of folks in our church don't know you, so I wanna give them a chance to get to know you real quick, so just let me ask you a few biographical questions, sure. All right? Name's Josh Rouse, how old are you?
I am 88 years old, I'm a Sagittarius. I wear a size 10 and a half shoe.
Okay, shut up, how old are you?
I'm 29.
He's 29 years old, which means he's a millennial, okay? Strike one. Sorry for cussing in church. All right. No. How long have you lived in Louisville now?
I've been in Louisville almost 6 years. I've been at Northeast that whole time.
Six years. So Josh and my timeline are almost exact because I moved here 6 years ago. He came here just like a few months after me. And the reason why, some of you may not know this, but the reason why is because Josh was my first hire here. I don't know if you guys knew that or not. Yeah? Okay. You clap, but you don't know him. All right? I'll say, if you like Josh, I'll take credit for that. If you don't, Bob Cherry was still technically the lead pastor, so blame him. Now, I've been here for a little over for 6 years, so I feel like it's my hometown. Really started to get to know it. I'm sure you have too. So tell us a little bit about what you love about Louisville. Where do you love to eat?
That's so hard. I'm such a foodie, and Louisville has the best local food scene. I love Butcher Town Grocery. It's amazing. Shout out Bobby Benjamin. But probably my favorite place is this little place in the Highlands called Holy Grail.
Holy Grail. Yeah. Where'd you eat last night?
I ate at Holy Grail last night.
Holy Grail. That's right. Okay, so what do you love to do in Louisville?
Yeah, I love Louisville parks. I love the outdoors, so I'll go down the road about an hour and a half to Red River Gorge a lot. I play a lot of sand volleyball here in Hintown too.
Yes, okay, and what you guys may not know about Josh and I is we go to the same gym as well. You can probably tell. And Josh, who's stronger?
I am stronger.
Don't.
Mentally.
Also, Josh is a butthead. Okay, so you started as our third through fifth grade pastor here at Northeast when we hired you on six years ago. And you love that because your degree from Kentucky Christian is in childhood development and in Bible. And yet, when we started really feeling like we needed to renew our vision for global outreach, and we started looking around internally for anybody who we felt like could meet that the needs of that position, we just kept coming back to you. So it was about 18 months ago that you shifted from third through fifth to global outreach. And were you pretty excited about that shift?
Yeah, I was very excited. I love to work with kids, of course. But I love even more to work with kids on an international level, as well as working with other nonprofits to do great work in developing countries. One of my biggest passions is just to remind people that when Jesus was here on earth, he didn't just preach. He didn't just teach people. He met people's physical needs. He healed them. He fed them. And the church, as it was expanding, did the same thing. And so I think my favorite aspect of my current position is getting to partner with, getting to come alongside seasoned faith-based nonprofits that bring the hope of the message of Jesus, but also bring the hope that comes along with meeting some very real physical needs for people.
That is so huge. See, this is what I think personally makes the church different than just your average charitable organization or humanitarian relief group. We have the unique opportunity to not just heal bodies, but to heal bodies and souls.
Right.
Bodies and souls. We can marry the two together, right? We can make a spiritual and physical impact on people. And a lot of times, you're never going to make a spiritual impact until you make a physical impact.
Right.
They won't hear the truth until they feel the love. And so, we say it around here like this a lot. You'll never make a point until you make a difference, right? And that's how we lead and love the Ville here, and that's how we want to lead love the Ville globally. So I love that. Okay, so I feel like God put this calling, and I call it a calling on purpose, this calling in your life for global outreach from a very, very young age, right? So talk a little bit about your childhood and how you got in, God lit this passion in your heart.
So I went on my first international short-term trip when I was very young, younger than most, 13 years old, I think, and it left quite an impression on me, so much so I started spending more and more time abroad in Haiti. I would spend basically any time I was out of school, so all summer long, breaks in January, breaks in March, breaks in April, all throughout school, all throughout college, even working with kids there and also our short-term teams that came in.
Yeah, so in my humble opinion, y'all, not only does Josh have the book smarts that comes with getting a degree in this stuff, but if actions speak louder than words, then he spent half of his life overseas. And so I think we've got a great guy in the right spot. Right man, right spot. He's humble. He would never tell you, about his own credentials, but we've got a guy leading there who is the right guy, and I'm glad. So check this out, it's a little story with that. So when Josh came here and I found out like his whole story about living half his life in Haiti, okay, yeah, you're such a Jesus follower. He told me that in his time there, he picked up Creole, which is one of the languages that most Haitian people speak. And he told me like he was fluent in it. Well, I didn't believe him. So I developed this plan one day to uncover his lie. And 2 years ago, I was presented with the perfect opportunity. We had this wonderful Haitian family show up at our church, and I got to meet them out in the lobby. And so I was talking to them, and I was like, hey, I got a question for you. Do you guys speak Creole by chance? And we're like, yeah, we speak it fluently. And I said, here's what I'm gonna do for you. I will buy your family lunch today. If you will walk across to our children's department right now, and you will find our third through fifth grade pastor, his name is Josh, and you just start talking to him in Creole. Just start talking to him, and then come back and report back to me after the service what he does. So they did it. And then they came back and reported back after service, and you know what I discovered about Josh? He's really stinking good at Creole. He's just, like, in fact, they came back and they're like, he has a regional dialect from this part, and he knows one of our like brothers and cousins, and I'm like, okay, shut up, that's enough, that's enough. So Josh was right, I was wrong.
Listen, we have a word for people like you in Creole. I can't tell you it right now, but I'll tell you.
Okay, all right. So one of the first things we asked Josh to do when we moved him to the global outreach spot was to actually just spend some time praying, thanking, starting conversations, researching best practices in global outreach so that he could help us marry that to our unique DNA at Northeast Christian Church, and we could come up with a strategy and philosophy that was uniquely us. And I want to throw a paragraph up on the screen behind you because this represents hours upon hours, months upon months of research and prayer. And this is sort of a summary of our global outreach philosophy going forward. Now, again, there's a lot behind every word on this screen. But for those of you who want kind of the short version of it, you might want to take a picture of this because this is who we are and this is where we're heading going forward. I'm going to read it to you right now. And then we're going to spend the rest of our time sort of tearing apart some of the key words and ideas behind me. Northeast's global outreach ministry seeks to bring hope. And we already talked about what this hope is. It's the hope of Jesus, right? The hope of Jesus to underprivileged communities around the world by meeting their spiritual and physical needs. Spiritual and physical needs. It's not or, it's and. Spiritual and physical needs. And we accomplish this by fostering long-term strategic partnerships with organizations that, and these are kind of our three non-negotiables for our partners. All right. One, develop sustainable initiatives and empower nationals to bring about positive change in their communities. Two, incorporate a healthy and sustainable model for short-term trips into their strategy with us. And three, serve with the love of Jesus and work alongside of the local church in some capacity. One, two, and three. All right. Now, I think everybody kind of gets the point about the hope of Jesus part. We've already talked about that. So I want to move from the why to the who there, that second sentence.
Right.
We bring hope by fostering long-term strategic partnerships. Who are our current partners, and tell our congregation a little bit about,
sure,
about them.
So currently we partner with five different organizations. One is called El Oasis in Santiago, Chile. They focus primarily on college and young adult ministry. We also partner with an organization in Jacmel, Haiti called Jasper House. They're a women empowerment organization. So they rescue women who have been trafficked, who are in abusive relationships. They give them housing, education, vocational training, counseling. We partner as well with two organizations in Cochabamba, Bolivia, Compassion and Stadia. They plant churches there, but they also plant child development centers where they plant churches. We also have two global nonprofit partners here in our own city. One is called Kentucky Refugee Ministries. They're a refugee resettlement organization that we partner with to resettle refugees here in our city who come from countries where they've experienced persecution or civil war. And then last, we partner with an organization called Supplies Overseas, which is an MSRO, which basically just means they collect donated medical supplies and equipment, and they ship them at no cost to medical nonprofits in developing countries around the world.
Yeah, so real quick, I just want everybody to notice, that's only five. That's
right.
Five partners. That's not a lot. Okay, in fact, I know a lot of churches, here's what churches have a hard time doing. They have a hard time saying no, because we're pastors, we love people, and so it's like, a lot of times you can see the ministry menu, the outreach menu get really, really big.
Sure.
But we have decided strategically to focus on not many more than five. I think we've talked about maybe six, seven, eight tops,
yeah,
right? So talk a little bit about why we just want to focus on a few.
Sure. So it's very common for churches our size, and this was the case for Northeast at 1.2, to partner with upwards of 10, 20, 30 global partners. The one negative thing that happens when you do that is you divide all of your resources, you divide all of your efforts by 30.
That's right.
So you divide your funding, you divide your volunteers, you divide your marketing by 30, and you're just not able to have a real impact on those communities. So we decided we wanted to have a more strategic, a more focused approach so that we could have a real impact on the communities that we were really passionate about.
Yeah. I mean, you guys know this in your own organizational context. focus fosters excellence, right? The more focused you can be, the deeper you can cultivate relationships. The more focused you can be, the more you can swing your weight in a big way. Okay, so this is a perfect example is Easter. All right, not long before Easter, we found out that one of our global outreach partners, the Jasper House in Jacmel, Haiti, was having some financial problems, some financial needs. And so because of that, on Easter, we were able to pull out the checkbook and write them a $50,000 check on the spot. Fund their ministry for the rest of the year. And if we were spread thin to 20, 30 different organizations, I'm not sure we would have been able to do that and come through in a big way. So we believe in focus. Now, at the top of that list is our most tenured partner, our most long-term partner, El Oasis in Santiago, Chile. By most tenured, I mean that our leader there, Greg Class and his wife, Ellie, he grew up in this church. Here's a picture of the two of them. Like, Greg grew up here after he got out of college. We were able to send him to Santiago. Santiago has 70 universities, thousands upon thousands of college students there. So talk a little bit about them, what we're doing with them.
So one of the things we started to do with each of our global partners is to just simply ask them the question, what do you need? What are your needs? Which sounds very simple because that's part of our DNA here at Northeast is to find out needs and to just meet those needs. But it's actually a pretty radical concept when it comes to global outreach because it means that we don't get to dictate what we do abroad anymore, that we don't even get to decide what our short-term teams do. We trust, we rely on our global partners to set that agenda for us. So we asked our partners at El Oasis, Greg and Ellie, what do you need? And they came back with to us with two things in particular. The first revolved around the retreats that they do. So they take several times throughout the year retreats with a couple hundred college students and young adults, and they're very, very impactful. They see a lot of life change, a lot of discipleship take place on these retreats. Unfortunately, even though they're only about $20 per person, a lot of their students just simply cannot afford that. So they have to go on a payment plan to pay off that $20 over the period of a year. So we've come in a couple times and we've just paid the remaining balances for all the students on their accounts, just to make it easier for students to continue to go to those life-changing retreats year after year for them. The other thing that they asked help with, unfortunately, there's a lot of sexual abuse and sexual assaults in Santiago. And there are a lot of victims of sexual assaults in El Oasis. But when they come forward, they either can't afford counseling, or when they find a counselor they can't afford, usually it's about 6 months out before they can be seen. So we've stepped up and said that we will not only pay for all of the counseling, for any mental health issues, for any student at El Oasis, in particular victims of sexual assault, but that we will help expedite the process and get them counseling immediately.
Amen. Yeah. That just blew my mind when we first talked about this. $20. So you come in here some Sundays, the offering's passed, you throw a 20 in the plate, and you don't think much of it, right? I wish I could put some of the faces and the names of these young people across the world who you might not meet this side of heaven, but I wish I could put them here on stage and allow them to say thank you to you, because even just for $20, you're able to make an eternal impact on their lives. All right, so that's the who. That's the who. Here are some of our strategies. Give me the paragraph again there. At the bottom, you see 1, 2, and 3. These are our three strategic non-negotiables for our partners, and I just want to take them in order. The first one is we want to develop sustainable initiatives that empower nationals. Sustainable initiatives that empower nationals. Talk a little bit about what that means, why that's important, Josh.
So in the international development realm, there's a big difference between and sort of a debate going on between which is more important, relief or development. Relief primarily being reactive to issues and development primarily being proactive to issues. And to be clear, I think both are important. For instance, last year we did a lot with hurricane relief in Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico. But we, for the most part, partner with organizations that focus on development. We want to have partners who prioritize the long-term health and development of communities that they're involved in. So that means teaching and training nationals or locals to better themselves and to better their communities.
Yeah. Okay, so just because they're from another country or they have a different color of skin doesn't mean they don't have an inherent giftedness or talent inside of them. And a lot of us forget that, right?
Yeah.
So the amazing part about being able to, rather than just give, but instead equip, empower, unleash, right? Not just a handout, but a hand, or a hand up. Not just a handout, but a hand up. The cool part about this is we get to see people unleash their human potential on the world that they already had inside of them. They just didn't have an opportunity to do.
And I think the best example that I can think of this is somebody that you and I have a close relationship with that we met through our partnership with KRM here in Louisville.
Yeah, so we started our partnership with Kentucky Refugee Ministries February 2017, 15 months ago. And So it basically started with us just calling them saying, hey, we want to help resettle some refugee families with you guys. Tell us what we want to do or what you need us to do. And they were like, okay, well, here's the deal. We got a lot of help right now. We got to get you trained. It's probably going to take 5 or 6 months before you get your get your family. But we were like, that's fine. We'll wait as long as it takes. We'd like to do a family or two this year, though. Well, then the next day, we got a call. For like 24 hours later from KRM's leadership, and they were like, we need some help. This doesn't usually happen, but we've got a family of 12 arriving from the Democratic Republic of Congo in 48 hours. We don't have anyone to sponsor them, and we need somebody to come through. Can you help us, please? And Josh was like, sure, we're the Loveville Church. And then like as soon as he got off the phone with them, he started calling. He couldn't, I remember he texted me, texted other staff leaders. He's like, we need some help. We need to gather a team. And so we did. And 48 hours later, we were there welcoming this beautiful family into the United States. Now, one of the young men in that family was a young man named Mandela. And I have been so proud to watch Mandela grow and develop over the last 15 months. He is going to change the world. Now, I could tell you his story. But instead, I've invited Mandela to come here today live and allow us to just interview him for a few minutes. So real quick, would you welcome Mandela to the stage? Mandela, where you at, man? Come on up. There he is. Come on up, my friend. Thanks for being with us, man. All right, hey, sit down real quick. And these folks are pretty nice, all right? They don't bite. I'm going to ask you a few questions, all right? Just so they can get a chance to get to know you, man. First off, tell us your full name.
My name is Mandela Gapara.
Right, and how old are you?
I'm 28 years old.
28, and what's your social security number? All right. I know this, but our church may not. What country did you come from?
I'm from Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Right. And before you came here, you lived in a refugee camp, right?
Yes, I was in a refugee camp with my family.
How long did you live in the refugee camp before you came to the United States?
I lived there 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, when you finally arrived with your family at Louisville International Airport in the United States for the first time, I just want you to take us back to that moment. What were you feeling? What were you thinking? What went through your mind when you got here?
So I was so surprised seeing so many white people. Having seen so many black people all my life.
Very white.
And, lots of white people.
Beside the people, I felt excited to see so many new things, such as the size of the airport and how busy the airport was. Yeah. Also, how people work with their dogs instead of work with their friends or families.
Right.
In my country, we have dogs, but we do keep dogs outside the house. We cannot work with them.
We were talking about this morning. I said, in America, we call them fur babies. Who's got a fur baby?
Yeah.
All right, just want you to see. Yeah. All right, check it out. Okay, so one of the things I respect so much about you, Mandela, is that when you arrived in the United States, over the next few months, you were a man on a mission to make a new life for yourself. And like, I couldn't be more prouder of you. I know when you got here, you didn't speak much English. You needed an interpreter to help you. But how long did it take you to learn English?
When I get here, my English was very poor. I had to use an interpreter to communicate. And I realized English was very important in America than in my country, Congo. That made me to focus. Then I went at KRM, Kentucky Refugee Ministries. I went there for 2.5 months.
So in 2.5 months, you learned English pretty good.
Yeah, I was able to speak it a bit.
Wow.
Communicate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you learned it well. So check this out. I was asking him this morning in the car. I was like, so how many languages do you know, Mandela?
I speak 7 languages.
That would be 7. Here in America, we speak American. That's about it. So, all right. So, Chet, thank you to the little guy out there who laughed at that.
Up there.
Yeah. All right. So you got a job pretty quick too. How long did it take you to get your first job?
I got my first job in April 2017, 3 months after my arrival.
So in 3 months, and where was your first job at?
At Amazon.
At Amazon. Yes. And you worked there for about a year, right? And now you told me recently you've got two new jobs, right?
Yes.
Two new ones. Where are your two new jobs at, man?
Yeah, now my full-time job, I work at Omni Hotel.
Yes.
And I work also at Kentucky Refugee Ministries.
So Omni Hotel, and you work now at Kentucky Refugee Ministries. And here's the cool part.
Yeah.
What do you do for Kentucky Refugee Ministries now?
At Kentucky Refugee Ministries, I am an interpreter.
Yeah, interpret English for me.
Yeah.
Thank you. Awesome. Yeah, man. On top of those two jobs, you are also a student. Where are you enrolled?
Yes, I'm a student at JCTC.
JCTC, and last semester, on top of those two jobs, how many classes did you take?
I took three classes.
Three classes,
yeah.
Man. You're an animal, dude. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay, so last question for you.
Mm.
What did it mean to you and your family to have a bunch of smiling, crazy white people there to meet you at the airport and having this group of Louisville natives to walk beside you and help you get started off on the right foot? What did that mean to you?
So adjustment can be challenging. When I first got here, I was like so stressed to see the people, like white people. Fortunately, when you introduce yourselves, I hear that you are from the church. That made me feel like I'm home, and it was very helpful. It was a pleasure to have you guys.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, no, one more question, all right? This is very important to our congregation. I gotta ask you this. Cats or cards?
Yeah, my loyalty is still open.
Ah, stay still open. Very diplomatic answer. Can you guys give Mandela?
Proud of you.
He's going to change the world, y'all. Here's what you may not know about him. In 18 months or so, he will be a U.S. citizen. He's refugee status now, but he's on the citizenship track, and he is also a Christian. And we didn't know that when he got off the... Oh, yeah, it's awesome. We didn't know that when he got off the airplane. That wouldn't have changed the way we loved him, but to now know, like Steve said earlier, that we were able to bear the burdens of one of our brothers in Christ just makes it all the more, you know, all the more fruitful and all the more endearing to us, so we're thankful for that. All right, can we throw the paragraph back up there? Second strategic non-negotiable. Our partners have to incorporate healthy and sustainable model for short-term trips with us into their strategy.
Great.
What's that? Why is that important?
Yeah. So what I found is that a lot of nonprofits do one of two things when it comes to short-term teams. They either have an unhealthy system for short-term teams that actually ends up harming the same communities that they're hoping to help over the long term, or the organization is so terrified of doing that that they don't do short-term teams at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a firm believer that we can do short-term teams and we can do them well. We can do them the right way. As long as we do two things, as long as we remember to do two things. And the first is to understand the community and the culture.
Yes.
I mean, really understand the community and the culture. Do our research. And the second is once we do that, to prioritize the community's needs over our desire to make us feel good.
Okay, say that again because that is such an important principle.
We need to prioritize that community's needs over our desire to make us feel good on a short-term trip. Now, let me give you an example to illustrate what I mean. We would never, for instance, lead a short-term team to Haiti to build a building, a church, a school, a house. Why? Because there's 40% unemployment in Haiti, and 80% of that is a manual labor force. So instead of stealing jobs off of Haitians, instead of spending $2,000 a person to go to Haiti to build a building, we could pay $500, that money could go right into the pockets of Haitian families to put food on the table, and then they could probably build a building better than our short-term team ever could.
Right, right. That tension is so important to understand, the tension between feel good and do good, the tension between feel good and the actual facts of what's best. Now, I know that your expertise in childhood development.
Right.
Talk a little bit about your passion concerning orphanages, because I know this is a little bit different than what some folks in here have probably heard before, but we've decided strategically not to partner with orphanages going forward.
Yeah, one of our non-negotiables is that we don't partner with organizations that have or support an orphanage in any way. And just as a quick disclaimer, to be clear, I'm not anti-orphan. I'm for kids.
Right.
I am, however, anti-orphanage or anti-children's home, whatever you want to call it, because like you said, it goes back to separating the difference between making ourselves feel good and facts, which is so hard to do. It's so difficult to do. But when we do that, the facts tell us something. The facts tell us that kids worldwide who grew up in orphanages are about 10 times more likely to be involved in prostitution in their life. They're about 40 times more likely to be incarcerated in their life, and they're over 500 times more likely to end their lives. The facts also tell us that about 85% of kids in orphanages worldwide are not true orphans. They have surviving parents. Wow. Parents who just couldn't afford to feed them three meals a day or schooling or medical care, so they chose to give their kids up and send them to an institution with the hope of their kids having a better life. Now, that percentage is actually closer to about 92% in countries like Haiti and in Cambodia. So, setting aside the abuse, the neglect, the money mismanagement, the fake adoptions that we hear about sometimes in orphanages, which do happen, and focusing only on the best of orphanages, only the ones that are most well-meaning, and they're still harmful to the long-term development of kids.
So let me ask you this then. What's the right, with our strategy here, what's the right alternative then? Because we're not anti-orphans. We want to lift orphans up. We want to come alongside them and you know, obviously help them. So what's the right alternative?
Yeah. So first of all, our short-term teams will never take a trip to visit an orphanage. It's called orphan tourism. It actually develops a lot of attachment disorders in kids. Second, we will always support, we will always strive for, we will always hope for family-based care for children, to try to keep families together.
Right. Resource those families, empower those parents, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So give me an example. Just recently, this is a perfect example. We got a chance to take a short-term trip to Jasper House in Haiti.
Yes.
A little bit before Easter. Talk about some of the strategy behind that trip.
Yeah.
How we went about it.
So about a year ago, we met with the leadership of Jasper House, and we asked them the question we ask of all of our partners: what do you need? What are your needs? And they told us a few things. They said, we need women's healthcare professionals. None of our girls have ever had any exams of any kind, period. They said, we need someone to come and teach a business and finance class to our girls. That's a big need here. We need somebody to help refine our sewing abilities in our vocational program. We need someone to come teach and train our counselor on staff who's in way over her head. Mm-hmm. So we got to work. We recruited our team to exactly match the needs that our partner presented to us. And we took down a woman who taught sewing in the vocational program, three ladies who taught a business and finance class all week to the women, two counselors who sat and taught and trained their counselor all week and sat in then on the counseling sessions. And we took two medical professionals to see girls all week long, one of whom was an OBGYN from here at Northeast named Jeannie Bramer.
Rockstar.
She saw about 50 girls that week. She diagnosed multiple diseases, multiple pregnancies. She taught a class on personal hygiene, on birth control. She even, at the end of the week, diagnosed a breech baby, rushed the mom to the hospital, got her an emergency C-section, and saved the lives of the mom and the baby. And I know I'm convinced, and I know she's convinced that that never would have happened if we hadn't decided to meet the needs of our partners in the first place. But the most important thing that she did, the most amazing thing, this is Sustainable Development 101, is before she left, she partnered Jasper House with a local women's clinic to meet all of the ongoing needs that they have for their women regarding health care. She worked herself out of a job.
Yeah, that's great. So real quick, I know that we've got a lot of medical professionals in Louisville and in our church community, and I know that our sixth partnership that you're currently investigating is potentially with a medical nonprofit out in Asia. You are actually leaving to go visit them tomorrow. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I leave tomorrow morning. I haven't packed yet. I'm not sure why I'm here. So I leave tomorrow. The most exciting thing about that potential partnership is they fully get our idea of sustainable development. So much so, in fact, their medical short-term teams, they require to do about 90% teaching and training and only about 10% practice. They don't want them coming in doing the same surgeries every year or treating the same diseases every year. They would much prefer that they come in and teach and train nationals, locals, to do what they can do so that when they pack up and go home, they leave those abilities behind for them to continue to meet the needs of the community.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so last word here because we are just out of time. Actually, okay, you know what Mandela told me in the car on the way here? He said, I really like your services, but they're so short. Back in Africa, we used to come for 3.5 hours on Sunday morning. So I was thinking about extending the 11 o'clock service, but last words real quick, and then I'll close things up. Anything else you want to say to our congregation?
I would just reaffirm that global outreach matters. It's biblical and it matters. That the work our partners are doing overseas matters. That being the Love the Ville Church that sees and meets people's needs, not just here in our own city, but abroad, matters. And I'll just say the quote that I always tell people, where you live shouldn't determine whether you live.
That's right. Yeah. Can you guys thank Josh?
Thank you.
Thank him. Thanks, man. I think we got the right guy there. Can you throw the paragraph up one more time? Our third non-negotiable at the bottom that I wanted to say for last is this. We demand that every one of our partners serve with the love of Jesus and work alongside the local church. And that's because we believe that ultimately, Jesus is the hope of the world. And the church, us, we are his body, his physical expression in the world. I remember the first time God grabbed my heart for global outreach. I grew up knowing the importance of it in my head, but he grabbed my heart about 3 or 4 years ago when I got to visit one of our churches and child care development centers in Cochabamba, Bolivia. As you guys know, we've planted 5 churches there. There's about 1,000 kids we have in those churches that we're sponsoring, and those churches double over as child development and education centers throughout the week. It's a really, really neat thing. I got to visit our first one in a little village called Pucara. Now, when I traveled into Pucara, it's kind of funny. We were driving through the village. I mean, it wasn't even a road. It was just dirt and rocks. As I looked around at the dilapidated huts, half-finished houses, the malnourished kids, no AC, no fridges, no electricity, no indoor plumbing, I thought to myself, how in the world can there be any hope here? But then we came around the corner, and I saw our church. We got some footage of it here. And in front of our church, there was a party already going on. A bunch of families, a bunch of kids, waving Bolivian flags, dressed up in traditional garb, singing songs, dancing. But when the van pulled up, the kids opened up the doors and they actually kind of pulled us pastors out of the van. And then they led me, Joey Keck, Jason Shreve, up to the front door of the church where their pastor, Pastor Isidoro, same age as me, handed me a pair of scissors. And then he asked me, on behalf of Northeast Christian Church, to cut the ribbon on the door of their church. It's one of the coolest moments of my life. And then we got to go inside and we just worship together. Now, I didn't have much of a clue of what was going on because it was in Spanish, you know. I mean, like, I knew when, you know, they were singing and preaching and stuff. But as I sat there just reflecting, I couldn't help but think to myself, man, this is just right. This is right. All these kids fed and educated. All these families strengthened, both physically and spiritually. A clean water well outside that we built on church grounds. A little soccer field, okay? And it wasn't like anything nice. It was a flat piece of dirt with no rocks on it. But there wasn't anything like that in the community, right? So a little soccer field outside for the kids to play on, man. It just felt right. It felt like God was all over it. In fact, you know what one of the compassion workers leaned over and said to me? He said, you do know that this church is the first church ever in Pucara. And I said, ever? And he said, yeah, ever. Like in the history of the planet Earth, never before has the church come here. Yeah. And I just thought then and there, I'll spend the rest of my life doing this over and over again. Because now the people of Pucara know that Jesus is alive. And he is love because God's great love met their great need through us. So Jesus said it 2,000 years ago, go make disciples of all the nations, be my witnesses everywhere. And I'll say it to you again. Church, let us never tire of that. Heavenly Father, ignite, revive in our hearts once again a fire for your global mandate to take Jesus' love and his truth to everyone everywhere. Send the Holy Spirit to help. And it is in Jesus' great name that we do it, we pray, and that we go today. Amen. Hey, thank you so much for being here today. Here's what I'd encourage you to do. Please wait, hold on just one second. Out in the lobby, we have 3 different tents set up where you can take some next steps. Like, immediately, everybody can't go on a short-term trip, right? So if you want to get involved in our global outreach right here, right now, today, we have a tent for Workout for Water, which is a workout coming up in about a month. We have a tent for KRM, our Refugees Partnership, if that interested you. And we also have a tent for supplies overseas. So please go check those tents out, get some more information, get involved today. Thank you guys very much. Have a good week.